Speaking to us from Minnesota today is Joan Nabar, mother of Sam, a National Guardsman from that state. Joan Nabar is also a mental health therapist. She began by telling the story of Sam's enlisting in the Guard.
Well, my son joined, you know, like a lot of young people, to help with college tuition in about 2005. He completed his basic training, and then his plan was to go back to college where he was a junior. And we found out literally days before that he was being selected to go to Iraq, which meant he was leaving for training in 5 days. So he had to withdraw from college.
And at that point, had he known that he was eligible for deployment to Iraq or Afghanistan?
There was some talk of it, but initially it was unknown. So really, he didn't have much notice. Mm-hmm. He really thought he was going to school in fall, and instead he was on his way for training. And this was after Hurricane Katrina, so they had to go to training in Mississippi right after the hurricane went through. So he ended up training for 6 months, and his deployment lasted, with all of his training, his deployment lasted 2 years. He was in Iraq for 16 months. 15 in Baghdad, and it was before and during the surge when so many soldiers were being killed.
And so he came back, and did you notice any difference in Sam?
Of course. I mean, his unit, they're one of the longest consecutively deployed units in the history of the Guard. They were a combat unit. And they did, his particular group he was with, he did almost between 290 and 300 combat patrols. So, you know, when you say the word reintegration to help somebody adjust from that, for the soldiers as well as their families, it's, you know, it's an unimaginable adjustment.
Probably doing patrols a couple of times a day.
Oh, right. Right. I mean, and they, this was Baghdad. I mean, there were a lot of bombings being shot at was an everyday occurrence. And, I mean, so it was incredibly dangerous. Mm-hmm. And there were 2,600 soldiers of his whole unit, but with his group in Iraq, there was only about 40 of them were in Baghdad. The rest were in Fallujah, which was equally as intense, if not more, at that time.
So am I correct in thinking that some of the National Guardsmen that he trained with remained in Minnesota and others were deployed to Iraq, or did the whole unit go?
The whole unit went. The whole unit went. So it was the largest deployment since World War II. And so, I mean, it was very tough for families. The real struggle is you're not with any support group, and when they return to the community. So, I mean, that is another one of the real intense struggles. You know, I mean, the adjustment is incredibly challenging.
I think that's an important point to emphasize here, is with some of the combat units, the active Army combat units, for example, they actually go through some kind of decompression. They go back to Kuwait and they spend a couple of weeks there before they come back to the States. But you're saying that the National Guardsmen don't do that. They come directly back and then right into their
communities? No, I mean, Minnesota was more organized than most states, so they did have a week debriefing at Camp Ripley. But when you've been, think about it. And when you've been shot at for a year and a half, even a week debriefing it's the tip of the iceberg. But, you know, after being gone that long, they really, you know, they did the best they could, and they couldn't keep soldiers any longer because they hadn't seen their families. And so they come back to the community, and, you know, it's incredibly challenging for everybody.
And you're a mental health professional, so you were actually able to understand some of what he had gone through.
Right. I mean, that's what, you know, that's the other piece that I find so disturbing, is that just because you come up with this word reintegration, the reality is it's hell. what I think, because I talked to other families, you know, my son was home and I saw the struggles he was going through, but when I talked to other moms, their emotions and the gamut of feelings they were going through kind of were real similar to mine. So finally your loved one is home and you're crying, you're angry. I mean, you're not expressing that toward your loved one, but finally you're able to let down emotionally and everything comes flooding out. So I think another challenging piece of this is then soldiers are coming home to family members that have secondary trauma, and they're emotional as well. I mean, you have to deal with the fact that, first of all, you're so blessed to have your loved one home. Then the reality is they've been gone for 2 years, and everything has changed, as well as they've changed. And so trying to pick up the pieces and reconnect, the emotional reconnection is really challenging because they've been wired differently from the war, and you have your own secondary trauma. And so what I'm saying is it's a very emotional, challenging time for everyone. And your loved one needs you. To me, it's like the hurricane. The outside piece is the war. The eye of the storm is when they come home. But then you have to make it through the other side of the eye of the hurricane, and that's called reintegration. So reintegration is a catchphrase for something that's an incredibly challenging journey for it, that's different for every soldier and every family.
And what you did was you started talking with other moms, and then you created a project called Voices Not Heard.
Well, I'm working on that project right now. I mean, some of the things I did is, you know, I moved to be near a support group of women and who were also going through what I was going through. So I was in that group, and I did comic stories, but I did a lot of writing. And so as a result of my poetry and the women I met, I decided that I really wanted to tell the stories of the women I've met, and I met a lot of amazing mothers, and perform their stories either with them or without them, depending on what they're comfortable with, because the stories are so compelling. I'd go to the meeting through the most difficult part of the deployment. There may be 30, 40 women around a table with a few fathers. Mm-hmm. And you would go around and everybody would talk about what's going on with their child. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, you're hearing these stories. And we all live through the extension together. I mean, we found out about the extension from the press. And we found out before our loved ones found out that loved ones are being extended for months.
Uh-huh.
So at this point, it was January. We thought our loved ones were coming home in March. Then we find out in January they won't be home till July.
Wow.
You can imagine the pain. So in a meeting, you would go around and you'd hear the stories of the very first meeting I went to, on either side of me, there were women who were National Guard mothers whose sons had traumatic brain injuries, and they continued to be deployed. And then they were sent back out. So one of the women I met, the very first, her son had lived through two explosions, so he was exposed to two traumatic brain injuries. So you hear those stories, and at the same time you're passing around cards for mothers whose kids have been wounded, or we'd pass around cards for soldiers from Minnesota who had been killed, because there were those who were killed as a result of this deployment and many who were wounded. And occasionally there'd be cards passed around for soldiers who came home and committed suicide. So you can't imagine the incredible scene of these women and their faces and their stories. And that has just moved me. And that, you know, that's, my son will be home 2 years this July. So I really want to honor the voices of the stories and the women that I met during that time by telling some of their stories in a performance piece. And that will be called Voices Not Heard, because in all honesty, I mean, mothers are so torn about what to do. Should they protest? Should they be quiet? How can they cope? And so you don't hear a lot of their stories or their voices. And when you have a loved one deployed, you hear incredible, difficult stories and stories of survival and triumph as well. And I just think it's important to listen to these voices of women, because these are stories we haven't heard.
Talk a little bit about that paradox that the mothers are stuck in between, with the wanting to talk, wanting to protest, and then feeling constrained because their son or daughter is still in the military somehow.
Well, of course, a lot of families feel like there's that whole retribution thing you fear. And I joined Military Families Speak Out kind of early on because I felt like I had to stay sane. And then individually, I personally decided I would speak out against the Iraq War, and I would do it in certain ways just to keep my sanity. And other parents I talked to said a similar thing, that so the thought went through my mind, if my son did not come home and I didn't speak out, I couldn't live with myself. But I felt like there were some things I could do within reason. You know, I didn't want to communicate to him that I did not love him, or I did not understand that he was in a very, I mean, he was in combat. He was in Baghdad. He was being shot at. Mm-hmm. I mean.
Exactly, yeah.
But on the other hand, the policies and the extension and how the soldiers were being treated and all those concerns, I just decided I had to speak out in some ways. And so that's what I did. But a lot of moms, you know, you're just so torn. And then some moms might be called unpatriotic. And so you're in terrible agony. I mean, when you have a child that's deployed, you know, Americans like to say that things are happening. They use this phrase, things are happening in real time. Well, war, I mean, life is in real time. War is in real time. So every day is agony for a mother or father or loved one who has someone deployed. And when you know that, you know, for example, you know, I can only imagine what parents who have a loved one deployed in Afghanistan right now are feeling. I mean, my son was in Baghdad during the surge when 122 soldiers sometimes were dying a month. Mm. And you never know when your son or daughter is going to call, so you keep a cell phone with you. And occasionally you notice a change in their voice, and they might say, well, I've got a mission coming up. And you know from how they talk and what they say that it's, you know, it could be something dangerous. And so what I'm saying is you're living with that internally, and then you have to go to work, and people around you have no comprehension of what your daily reality is.
Barely even know that there's a war on, in fact, sometimes.
No. And see, I was working as a therapist at the time, and one of the occasions I was with some other therapists at a meeting. And even though these were like very professionally trained, well-educated people, a mental health professional said to me, Joan, is it true that the guys on the front lines have low IQs? And I was speechless. So mothers are going through this, what can I do to keep my sanity, to honor my son, yet what do I feel like I need to do as a mom? I mean, most of us would not think of getting between a mother bear and her cub, because the reality is that bond is so fierce, we know she would do everything in her power to protect her young. Why should an American mother be any different? So when I would hear the word, you're not patriotic or whatever, I would think, that's not my reality. To me, I had to honor where I was at. And I could also respect mothers who felt that they could not speak out, because, in fact, it could jeopardize your child. I mean, somebody could lash out at your child.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that when you went to these meetings, it was mostly women and mothers, but you said there were a couple of fathers there.
Yes.
There seems to be more of a constraint upon the men, doesn't? At least in my opinion, there seems to be more constraint upon the men about speaking out. You see fewer of them. The ones that do show up are quite vocal, it's true. But the women tend to be much more likely to get into a group and to support one another in the way that you've described the women in your community.
Right. Right. I mean, I think mothers and fathers suffer. And I think they do different things about it. And I think, like you said, women tend to find other mothers they can be with and either, you know, and I did the same, you know, you send out packages. But then sometimes you also demonstrate or speak out. Well, I think as a mother, and this is in honor of Mother's Day, I mean, mother, you know, it's a visceral connection you have with your loved one. And to me, part of being a mother is this bond of protection. And, you know, it's an ancient thing. How many mothers since the beginning of time would want their child to be killed, wounded, or risk their life for senseless war? Mm-hmm. And so for me, you know, being in a group helped, writing helped. Occasionally I would stand with a sign somewhere. One Mother's Day I stood with a sign at the Capitol building in St. Paul, and I had a red cloth, and on the red cloth I had white roses, and I thought this month, and it was for Mother's Day, so I stood there alone with this red cloth and white roses, and I just stood there for an hour because I thought this is going to be my way to keep my sanity this Mother's Day. And this man comes up to me with these two little towhead kids, and he's well-dressed, and he says, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, my son is in Iraq, and I'm just standing here to honor him and the other soldiers serving there." And he looked at me, said, "Well, I'm rich, and I'm never going to have to worry about my kids serving," and he walked away. I mean, it was so bizarre. But then his little daughter came back and reached out her hand to me. She was like 3 years old, so because she could see kids can connect emotionally. So she could see I was just standing there in some kind of pain doing that. So she kind of reached out her hand, and he just turned on his heel and walked away. So I think the agony of the Iraq deployments or these deployments. The other part is that there's 1% of Americans that are carrying this burden. And the rest of Americans, at times, some of us have felt like you've turned on your heel and walked away.
Well, and this feeds into what you said about the other therapist that you work with who asked about the IQ of the people that enlist.
Right, right. Because not only did that mental health professional say that, then another one said, well, you know, they're all the same or something like that. And it was all I could do to keep from screaming. And at this point, my son was in his last days of his deployment, and it was getting really bad. And he was helping search for some soldiers who had been kidnapped, and it's 122 degrees there. And my coworkers are making comments like this to me.
You're 18 years old, and you're wearing somebody's brains around on your shirt because they got their head blown off right next to you. And that's not supposed to affect you. I can never understand. What would scare me is if we were to send a group of 18-year-olds 12,000 miles away and subject them to a year of that obscenity and have them not be affected. That's what would frighten me.
You're listening to Raising Sand Radio on KZSU Stanford. We're talking to Joan Nabar, mother of Sam, a Minnesota National Guardsman who was deployed to Iraq for 16 months. Joan Nabar is also a mental health professional, and she goes on here to talk about the lack of awareness amongst her colleagues, friends, and the general U.S. population not directly involved in issues of war and peace and who don't make it their duty to learn more.
When soldiers come home, you're trying to heal in an environment that is emotionally disconnected from what you've been through, and they continue to be emotionally disconnected. Mm-hmm. And maybe if they knew more, they would be say and do more sensitive things. If you say, "We support the troops," or whatever, that means nothing. It's action. Actions speak louder than words. So you do things. You act in a compassionate way. You do things that are compassionate. You make sure families know they're not alone. You offer to help. You offer to listen. It's not about having to donate money. It's about the emotional connection and what can I do, not just waving a flag or sticking a yellow stick. sticker on your car.
It's also about educating yourself to know exactly how the military works, doesn't it? So the amount of money that goes into the military, who gets signed up, how they get signed up, you know,
right.
what that whole recruitment thing is about.
Right.
All of those things are part of being a citizen, I think, and we're not really getting that.
No, I mean, a lot of times when I just mentioned I had a son deploy, I mean, a lot of people don't know that they don't know anything about the deployment or what you've been through or the reintegration or what happened, you know, when our loved ones got extended. So what I'm saying is, how can you ask military families to heal or soldiers to heal when Americans are completely emotionally disconnected? Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, you've lived through hell. I mean, it's crazy making is what I'm trying to say.
Mm, it is, yeah.
It's very crazy making. So when I hear that there's 1,000 return soldiers a day attempting suicide, it breaks my heart, but I'm not shocked. If you know anything about mental health, basic mental health, or human development, how can you imagine that a human being can live through numerous deployments in urban guerrilla warfare in a civil war, where there are millions of people, men, women, and children around, civilians, you don't know who is who.
You don't speak the language. You don't know the culture.
No, no. And then you're there for a year and a half, mm-hmm. several deployments, you're stop lost, and you come back, and soldiers are struggling, and families are struggling, and people are having suicide attempts. To me, it was a recipe for disaster. As a mental health professional, it's another thing I found horrifying is that how can we act surprised now?
Right. And I have this theory, Joan Nabar, tell me what you think of it as a therapist, is the soldiers themselves, the troops themselves, need to be talking a lot more about what they went through. They tend to hold it in, and I think part of their role when they're, you know, when they're, I don't know if rehabilitated is the word we want to use, but when they're feeling up to it, is to actually start talking really about what went on in war and begin to educate the population.
But you know what? They need to do that in a safe and trusting environment. Mm-hmm. And so they need to find, because for sure most soldiers aren't going to want to tell
right.
mom and dad,
yeah,
aren't
exactly.
going to want to tell their husband or wife or brother or sister, because, you know, what I hear is you don't understand. And the reality is I know that that's true. So they need to find safe places where they can talk. That's very true. And so that might be through a vet center. A lot of communities have those. It might be through the VA, or it might be through private counselors. There's a lot of people in private practice that will volunteer time, because sometimes soldiers want to talk to somebody in the VA, and sometimes they don't because they're afraid it might go in their permanent file and somehow it will come back to harm their future work.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, you're right. It's very important to find ways to talk. I mean, one thing I did and that other communities can do is there's a retreat center here in my city of Duluth, and it's a non-denominational thing, and I said, listen, you know, as a mom, I've been struggling, and I'm wondering if you would do a retreat for women touched by the war. And so they did it. They offered a, you know, just a little weekend retreat, and we advertised. I did the advertising, and we had 13 women come. It was 2 days, one overnight. There were scholarships, so anybody could come. Half of the women who came were wives of Vietnam veterans.
Interesting.
Half of them.
Yeah.
And there's so much healing that needs to be done physically, emotionally, spiritually, whatever your spiritual practice is. If communities could reach out and offer that to families or to soldiers, there's so much that needs to be healed and talked about. And one thing that you long for after that kind of a brutal experiences, you just long for compassion and acceptance and validation and nurturing. So much of that needs to happen for soldiers and for their families, just a place where they can feel validated and talk, where soldiers can talk and where they can feel safe, as well as for families.
That was Joan Nabar, mother of Minnesota National Guardsman who was deployed to Iraq, and a mental health professional who finds a real lack of awareness about troops and war among her mental health colleagues.